Meanwhile, the Taliban have accused the prince of committing war crimes on his military tour in Afghanistan. Abdul Qahar Balkhi, the spokesperson for the Taliban-led Afghan Foreign Affairs Ministry, described the Western occupation of Afghanistan as a horrible moment in human history, saying comments by Harry is a microcosm of the trauma experienced by Afghans at the hands of occupation forces who murdered innocent people without any accountability. Last year, an investigation revealed commandos in the UK's elite Special Air Service Corps killed at least 54 Afghans in suspicious circumstances during a six-month tour of Helmand Province from November 2010 to May 2011, but the military chain of command concealed concerns. The investigation found that unarmed Afghan men were routinely shot dead in cold blood by SAS troops during nighttime raids during the long war in Afghanistan, and weapons were planted on them to justify crimes. In 2001, the US and its close allies, including the UK, invaded Afghanistan under the pretext of fighting Al-Qaeda. The invasion preceded by over two decades of war in Afghanistan and cost 241,000 lives.
The United States has yet again imposed a fresh round of sanctions against the Islamic Republic, this time targeting the country's suppliers of drones Washington claims Russia has been using in the war in Ukraine. The sanctions targeted six executives and board members of Kos Aviation Industries. The U.S. Department of Treasury said the group, which has been under U.S. sanctions since 2013, was a key Iranian defense manufacturer responsible for designing and producing drones. Washington said the drones have been used to target civilian infrastructure in Ukraine during the conflict with Russia. Among those designated was Sayed Hojatollah Qureshi, Quds Aviation Industries board chairman and senior official in Iran's Ministry of Defense and Armed Forces Logistics. The Treasury said Qureshi had led Iran's military research and development efforts and was responsible for negotiating Iran's agreement with Russia for the supply of the Iranian drones for the war in Ukraine. The Treasury also imposed sanctions on Qasem Damovandian, Quds Aviation Industries managing director and board member. It said he had likely facilitated the group's supply of drones to Iran's military services and the training of Russian personnel on the use of drones. The accusations come as Iranian officials say Ukrainians have so far failed to provide any evidence for their claim that Russia was using Iranian drones in its war on Ukraine. Speaking following a technical meeting between Ukrainian and Iranian experts, Iran's Defense Minister Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Ashtiani said the Ukrainian side had stopped short of presenting any evidence of Russia's use of Iranian drones in its war in Ukraine. Prior to that, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian had also reacted to the U.S. and other Western countries' allegations, noting that Tehran had provided Moscow with a limited number of drones, but the delivery had taken place months before the war in Ukraine. The sanctions come as the U.S. Treasury says it will continue to use every tool at its disposal to deny Russian President Vladimir Putin the weapons he is using to wage his unprovoked war in Ukraine. The Friday sanctions also targeted the director of Iran's Aerospace Industries Organization, which the Treasury claimed was the key organization responsible for overseeing Iran's ballistic missile programs. The move freezes any U.S. assets of those designated and generally bars Americans from dealing with them. Those engaged in certain transactions with the targeted individuals also risk being hit by sanctions. The United States has previously imposed sanctions on companies and people it accused of producing or transferring Iranian drones that Russia has used to attack infrastructure in Ukraine. The military-related sanctions on Iran are just a small part of the U.S. so-called maximum pressure campaign against the Islamic Republic. Washington has left no stone unturned in pressuring Tehran to fulfill its demands, given that the so-called maximum pressure policy has so far failed to produce the intended result It is widely believed that by pressuring the government and subsequently the people of Iran, what the United States is and has been pursuing after 40 years of the Islamic Revolution is seeking regime change. The sanctions against Iran over its supply of drones to Ukraine comes as the West has itself been fanning the flames of the Ukraine war by providing billions of dollars worth of military assistance to Kiev. That includes the United States, Germany, France, and the UK. The weapons they provide range from mortar fighting vehicles and Leopard tanks like AMX-10RC armored combat vehicles and Abrams tanks. This is while providing Kiev with such weaponry could increase the risk of direct confrontation between Moscow and the West. Iran has been under the UN and US sanctions since the 1979 revolution. What comes to the spotlight is the futility of such all-out anti-Tehran measures. Despite 40 years of pressure and sanctions on the Islamic Republic, not only Iran has not stopped, but it has progressed, so the sanctions tactic has lost its effectiveness in a sense. This rather indicates that the United States seems to be escaping the frustration caused by its failure against the Iranian nation's iron will. The resilience of Iran's economy is not the only reason why the unlawful American maximum pressure campaign of sanctions against Tehran has failed. The maximum pressure policy against Iran was initiated by former U.S. President Donald Trump when he unilaterally pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal to strike a better agreement, which he hoped would restrict Iran's ballistic missile program and its influence in West Asia. Eventually, his hopes and aspirations became more and more far-fetched with each passing day. Now, the Trump-imposed sanctions regime has been maintained by the Biden administration, although they realize it has been an abject failure. Could this be because they see no alternative course of action? What seems to be of very high significance is the fact that the Biden administration has realized that Trump's so-called maximum pressure campaign not only didn't work, but only helped strengthen the Islamic Republic of Iran in the international arena. Yet Iran stands. How so? Iran's economy and partners are diversified with initiatives to circumvent such U.S. measures.
Sheikh Abdulaziz bin Zayed's recent trip to Damascus was the second time he met with the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad as the two Arab nations continued to warm up to each other. The two top diplomats discussed restoration of relations and boosting of economic ties, with Assad saying that they will help regional stability and Sheikh Abdullah expressing support for a diplomatic solution to the conflict in Syria, as he was joined by a group of economic and security officials on his visit. Relations between Syria and the UAE were severed after Syria was expelled from the 22-member Arab League all the way back in 2011. The UAE reopened its embassy in Syria in 2018. Bahrain, Algeria, and Jordan have also resumed ties with Syria, while other Arab nations are calling for Syria's reinstation to the Arab League. This trend has not been sitting well with the U.S., as officials have slammed the visit by Sheikh Abdullah. One U.S. senator has even threatened the UAE with sanctions in a tweet in typical Twitter fashion. UAE's outreach to the Assad regime provides little benefits to the Emirates. This carries huge risks to UAE's reputation, exposes it to Caesar sanctions, and hurts efforts to seek accountability for Assad's crimes against the Syrian people. The Caesar sanctions refers to the Caesar Syria Civilian Protection Act of 2019, also known as the Caesar Act. It is a U.S. legislation that not only sanctions the Syrian government, but also any entity, organization, or individual that provides funding or assistance to it. Iranian and Russian entities have been sanctioned under this act. It follows a pattern in U.S.'s attitude towards its foreign relations. If they don't want to conduct business with a country, no other country should be allowed to either. Sheikh Abdulaziz had criticized the Caesar Act back in 2021 during a meeting with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov. He said, "Bigger challenge today facing coordination and working with Syria is the Caesar Act," and further added, "To keep the Caesar Act as it is today makes this path very difficult, not only for us as a nation, but also for the private sector." To those comments, the U.S. replied that it would not ease up on its stances towards Syria, a stance they have maintained to this day, as apparent by their latest remarks surrounding the latest meeting between Turkish and Syrian officials. In the first time that Ankara and Damascus held talks among their high-ranking officials since 2012, defense ministers of both countries met in Moscow at the end of December. In that meeting, Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Çavuşoğlu said that he expects to meet with his Syrian and Russian counterpart later this month. This is a significant shift in Turkey's attitude towards Syria, as Ankara severed ties with the Arab nation back in 2012. And this shift has been met with a swift response from the U.S. When asked about the issue by reporters, Department of State spokesman Ned Price said, "We've made very clear to all of our allies and partners that now is not the time to normalize relations. Now is not the time to upgrade relations. Instead, in the eyes of the U.S., now is the time to impose further crippling sanctions on Syria, where the humanitarian conditions are deteriorating day by day, as the sanctions also include medicinal supplies." A UN special rapporteur on the negative impacts of unilateral coercive measures visited Syria and said that the sanctions have had catastrophic effects on the lives of Syrians as the country grapples with food and medicine shortages. She also said, "In the current dramatic and still deteriorating humanitarian situation, as 12 million Syrians grapple with food insecurity, I urge the immediate lifting of all unilateral sanctions that severely harm human rights and prevent any efforts for early recovery, rebuilding, and reconstruction." Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said on Thursday that he may meet his Syrian counterpart as part of a new peace process in the wake of the country's defense ministers' meeting. An Erdogan-Assad meeting will signal the official failure of U.S. attempts to topple the Syrian government through sanctions and boycotts, as it will show that U.S. allies are no longer listening to the will of America. It will cause embarrassment for the U.S., not quite on the level of their exodus in Afghanistan, but not too far off either.
The head of the International Monetary Fund, Kristalina Georgieva, has issued a dire warning over the economic outlook in 2023, saying that this year is going to be even tougher than the year 2022. That is because the U.S., EU, and Chinese economies have slowed down. The Ukraine conflict, soaring prices, and hiked interest rates, and the rise of the COVID have contributed to the slowdown in the global economy. She also said that a third of the world economy will be hit by a recession in 2023.
For most of the world economy, this is going to be a tough year, tougher than the year we leave behind. Why? Because the three big economies, US, EU, China, are all slowing down simultaneously. Half of the European Union will be in recession next year. China is going to slow down this year further. Next year would be a tough year for China. Mm-hmm. And that translates into negative trends globally.
Back in October, the IMF slashed its outlook for global economic growth in 2023. It blamed the gloomy outlook on the ongoing conflict in Ukraine and tougher monetary policies. According to Georgieva, China will face a very difficult start to the year 2023. That's because it is likely to grow at or below global growth for the first time in 40 years, she said.
China has slowed down dramatically in 2020. Two, because of this tight zero COVID policy. For the first time in 40 years, China's growth in 2022 is likely to be at or below global growth. That has never happened before. And looking into next year, for 3, 4, 5, 6 months, the relaxation of COVID restrictions would mean bushfire COVID cases throughout China.
She also said that the U.S. economy may avoid a recession, but warned a strong labor market there may lead the U.S. Federal Reserve to keep interest rates tight so as to combat high inflation, which could have negative economic consequences of its own. The IMF warning comes amid similar predictions by other institutions. UK-based Center for Economics and Business Research has said that the global slide into a recession next year, as a number of economies will contract due to surging borrowing costs introduced to combat inflation. K. Daniel Neufeld said, "We expect central bankers to stick to their guns in 2023, despite the economic costs. The cost of bringing inflation down to more comfortable levels is a poorer growth outlook for a number of years to come." The report is more pessimistic than the most recent forecast by the International Monetary Fund. Meanwhile, oil prices continue to slide, weighed down by China's rising COVID cases and a recession warning from the IMF. The warning comes amid a worsening economic crisis in developed nations. Just recently, Germany's Federal Statistical Office said that the country is grappling with its highest annual inflation in more than 70 years. According to official data, full-year inflation reached 7.9% in 2022 amid surging energy and food prices. The last time annual inflation was near that level was in the year 1951, when it stood at 7.6% as the post-war economic boom began. And the UK faces one of the worst recessions among the world's leading industrialized nations this year.
We're not the government. We haven't been in power for 12 years. Right, every aspect of society that's been impacted by government policy. 10 years of austerity, cuts to the economy, slowing growth, a badly handled Brexit, whatever your view on Brexit was, right, has all led to where we are today. But the fact that we've got so many people out on strike and so many people suffering, only the government can change it, or a change of government can change it.
The fallout from spiraling inflation triggered by the pandemic and the Ukraine conflict will persist for longer in the UK than in other G7 nations, and the country's recovery will be one of the weakest.
In the limelight.
President Joe Biden was confronted at the airport in El Paso, Texas, on Sunday, 8th of January, by Texas Governor Greg Abbott, who demanded in a hand-delivered letter that Biden act immediately to stop unauthorized immigration, including by building more walls on the U.S.-Mexico border. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. The Reuters news agency tells us more. President Joe Biden visited the U.S.-Mexico border on Sunday, 8th of January, for the first time since taking office, tackling one of the most politically charged issues in the country as he prepares for a re-election bid. Accompanied by Border Patrol agents, President Biden toured a section of the wall that divides the two countries, a signature priority of his Republican predecessor, Donald Trump, in an effort to demonstrate that he was taking the issue seriously. Joe Biden on Thursday, 5th of January, said his administration would tighten immigration enforcement by blocking Cuban, Haitian, and Nicaraguan migrants at the border, expanding the nationalities of those who can be expelled back to Mexico. But that has not impressed Republicans like Texas Governor Greg Abbott, who accused him of failing to enforce immigration laws. "You have violated your constitutional obligation to defend the states against invasion through faithful execution of federal laws," Greg Abbott, a possible 2024 presidential candidate, wrote in a letter he handed to Biden upon his arrival in Texas. Joe Biden told reporters he had not yet read the letter. Joined by Secretary of Homeland Security Alejandro Mayorkas, The president also visited the Bridge of the Americas, which connects the United States and Mexico, and viewed equipment that border officials use to detect illegal drugs. Joe Biden hopes to strengthen relations with Border Patrol agents, some of whom have bristled at the rollback of hardline enforcement policies by the White House. The long-term goal of Congress reforming America's creaky immigration system is unlikely to succeed, given Republicans' newly assumed control of the U.S. House of Representatives. Right-wing lawmakers have repeatedly torpedoed U.S. immigration reform proposals over the past two decades. Joe Biden sent Congress an immigration reform plan on his first day in office 2 years ago, but it floundered during opposition from Republicans, who also blocked his request for $3.5 billion to beef up border enforcement. Republicans are pushing their own plans for the border after securing a narrow majority in the House of Representatives in the 2022 midterm elections. Republican U.S. Representative Jim Jordan told Fox News Channel that President Biden should adopt the zero-tolerance policies pursued by his predecessor Donald Trump, which included separating children from their parents. "They've allowed now a situation where, frankly, we no longer have a border," Jim Jordan said. Alejandro Mayorkas on Sunday said international crises and legislative gridlock limited Joe Biden's ability to reduce the number of migrants making their way to the United States. "We're just dealing with a broken system," Mayorkas told reporters on board Air Force One on his way to Texas. El Paso's Democratic mayor declared a state of emergency last month, citing hundreds of migrants sleeping on the streets of El Paso in cold temperatures and thousands being apprehended every day. U.S. border officials apprehended a record 2.2 million migrants at the U.S. border with Mexico in 2022 fiscal year that ended in September, though that number includes individuals who tried to cross the border multiple times. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the story. President Joe Biden on Sunday, 8th of January, landed in Texas to visit the U.S.-Mexico border for the first time in his nearly 2 years as president, even as lawmakers and immigrant rights advocates have widely condemned his administration's latest hardline response to the deepening humanitarian emergency in Texas. President Biden, who's due in Mexico City this week for an international summit, made a brief pit stop in El Paso, Texas, a recent ground zero for the consequences of a U.S. immigration system that he has readily acknowledged is deeply broken. The reliably blue border city of El Paso in blood-red Texas has been struggling for months to triage thousands of stranded migrants and asylum seekers, many of whom have had little choice but to sleep on the streets in cold, rain and squalor. President Biden greeted local politicians at the airport, including Texas's hardline Republican Governor Greg Abbott, who has courted controversy with his stringent border policies, including busing migrants to Democratic cities in northeastern United States. Greg Abbott handed Joe Biden a letter that read in part, "Your visit to our southern border with Mexico today is $20 billion too little and 2 years too late." Joe Biden later traveled to the Bridge of the Americas border crossing, where northbound cars lined up to cross into El Paso, Texas from Juarez, Mexico. Wearing a suit and his trademark sunglasses, President Biden chatted to local law enforcement officers and watched demonstrations of border policing, including by a canine unit searching a car for contraband, as well as other techniques for finding drugs or helping migrants in medical distress. President Biden, accompanied by several members of Border Patrol, then also visited a migrant welcome center and a stretch of the border wall that runs between El Paso, Texas and Juarez, Mexico. The meetings took place with no press present aside from those watching at a distance. Biden answered a brief shouted question by promising more help for the border situation. "They need a lot of resources here. We're going to get it for them," he said. President Biden's first trip to the U.S.-Mexico border since his term started follows a record-breaking fiscal year of roughly 2.4 million migrant encounters there, amid a new normal of mass forced displacement because of regional instability, growing wealth disparities, climate change, and targeted persecution in various countries throughout the hemisphere. It also comes mere days after the Biden administration announced new changes to federal migration-related policies, which engendered immediate and intense backlash from pro-immigrant organizations as well as progressive members of the Democratic Party.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
This is the show A to Z. For today's program, Brother Muhammad is going to talk to us about Islamic education. Stay tuned.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In today's discussion with regards to Islamic education, we would like to look at an important aspect of the life of a Muslim. And this is, in fact, one of the important practices in the Islamic faith, and that is the prayer, Salah. Salah is such an important aspect of religion that it is called the pillar of faith. And indeed, inculcating and educating our children with regards to Salah is an important responsibility of the parents. The parents need to realize that on one hand, there are different ways they can go about teaching Salah, but the most important way is the practical role modeling of Salah. Indeed, when the parents themselves stand to pray, the children get interested in what is going on and they would like to emulate their parents in Salah. Now, on one hand, apart from emulating it, it's not necessary for us to force them, as the process of nurturing Salah needs to be done over a span of time with important introductions and reminders at stages along the way. And the children need to be taken slowly and gradually without any extremism, without any excess, and thereafter slowly guiding them through the process of Salah. One of the very important ways of teaching the details of Salah is, again, role modeling and practically showing and demonstrating the different acts of Salah. We find in the traditions and the lifestyle of the Ma'sumin alayhim as-salam, the Holy Infallibles, that they would likewise take the time out and explain and demonstrate for their followers or those who come to ask the precise method of praying Salah. And this is again very important because when the observer is observing the demonstration, they look at fine details as well. And the demonstrator as well has an opportunity to lay out the fine details and place reminders here and there to grab the attention of the listener. Now, on one hand, we find Rasulullah himself, when he began the process of Salah and teaching it to the Muslims, when Salah became an obligation on them, Rasulullah stood for prayer and he said, "Sallu kama ra'aytumuni usalli." Pray just like you see me praying. And indeed, Rasulullah, when he would pray, he would not only pray with the wajibat, but he would pray with the mustahabbat. And truly, Rasulullah's state would change when he would be praying Salah. And indeed, this was a source of inspiration, the fountainhead of Salah, the person who was who had the most perfect Salah, teaching the Muslims how to pray Salah. And indeed, the Muslims learned from that and they implemented it in their lives. When we look at the lifestyle and the traditions from the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam, we find that the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam would, on one hand, not only encourage their companions to pray Salat, but as time would pass and as they would grow older, the expectations would grow as well. And they would expect their companions to be praying Salah with its etiquette. But when it came to introducing and demonstrating Salah, we have a tradition from Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam that his companion Hammad came to him. And he said, "Oh Imam, can you please show me how to pray Salah?" And Imam stood with a very straight, erect posture, and he stood facing the Qibla, and he placed his hand on his thighs, and his feet were together with a span of three fingers between them, and they were all facing towards the Qibla without any deviation, and with all humility and attention, he stood and said, "Allahu Akbar." And he recited Surah Al-Hamd, Surah Al-Fatiha, and Surah Al-Tawheed. And he recited them with tartil, with recitation in measured tones. And thereafter, after completing the recitation of the surahs, he paused for refreshing his breath. And he said, "Allahu Akbar." And he raised his hands near his face and he went into ruku'. And thereafter, the tradition continues in such detail. It tells us exactly how Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam prayed Salah. When he bent for ruku', his back was straight such that not a single drop, if it fell on his back, would go in any specific direction. And thereafter, he recited Subhana Rabbi al-Azim wa bihamdi. He stood up again straight without any bendings. When he stood up straight again, he said, "Sami Allahu liman hamida," and said, "Allahu Akbar," and went again into the state of sujood. And when he placed his hands, he made sure the seven body parts that are supposed to be on the ground were specifically on the ground. And this is where he even told Hammad that, "Oh Hammad, these are seven parts of the body that must be on the ground." And as the verse of the Holy Quran says, وَأَنَّ الْمَسَاجِدَ لِلَّهِ فَلَا تَدْعُوا مَعَ اللَّهِ أَحَدًا. He said, the masajid here refers to the seven parts of the body that need to be on the ground. And Imam alayhi salam continued, and Hammad is documenting this salah of Imam As-Sadiq in such detail that if a person even today was to read this, he can actually picture exactly how the demonstration by Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam was presented. So indeed, we learn from this tradition that when we are teaching our children how to pray, let's not just expect them to watch us on our own salah, on our own when we pray our salah. Rather, we should take the time out and we should demonstrate to them each and every detail of salah properly with explanations such that the children themselves are able to pray salah. Let's not leave it on the madrasa or the school or another person. Rather, it is important on ourselves as parents to take the time out and pray Salah properly and make sure our children are able to pray Salah properly. I hope you enjoyed today's discussion. Until next time, fi amanillah, under God's protection.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
In the limelight.
According to reports of international human rights organizations and civil institutions in Afghanistan, since the occupation of the country by the U.S. military and its allies in October of 2001 until the time of their chaotic withdrawal from Afghanistan in 2021, thousands of innocent Afghan civilians have been killed and tens of thousands more have been injured. But the American authorities have never been held accountable for their heinous crimes in the country. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Russia Today has covered the story and tells us more. An internal military review reportedly concluded that U.S. analysts' incorrect presumptions and prejudices contributed to the chaotic August 2021 Pentagon departure from Afghanistan and resulted in a Kabul drone attack that killed 10 civilians, including 7 children. Tensions were running high on the day of the drone strike, just 3 days after the August 26th terrorist bombing that killed 13 U.S. troops and more than 100 Afghans at Kabul airport. The probe by U.S. Central Command, or CENTCOM, noted that another attack by Daesh terrorists was expected that day and that intelligence reports indicated it would involve a white Toyota Corolla. The report said military analysts observed a white Toyota Corolla stopping at what they believe was a Daesh compound, so they began tracking the car. After the vehicle pulled into a gated courtyard near the airport just hours later, a Hellfire missile strike on the car by an MQ-9 Reaper drone was ordered. Later on that day, U.S. officials announced that they had successfully prevented another terrorist attack. As reports of civilian deaths began to surface, U.S. officials said they had no indications of such casualties and were investigating whether a secondary explosion might have killed someone. However, CENTCOM's investigation revealed that analysts reported within 20 minutes of the strike that civilians may have been killed. Within 3 hours, they had assessed that at least three Afghan children, were killed. Military officials continued to conceal what they knew about the strike. 3 days later, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, said the attack was righteous and that it had killed a Daesh facilitator and unknown others. The driver of the Toyota Corolla turned out to be an aid worker who had spent the day picking up his employer's laptop, taking colleagues to and from work, and loading canisters of water into his trunk to bring home to his family. The CENTCOM investigation was completed a week and a half after a drone strike and was never released to the public. 16 months later, the US media obtained 66 partially redacted pages of the report, only after suing CENTCOM under the Freedom of Information Act. The probe detailed how biases led analysts to make tragically wrong assumptions. For instance, they concluded that a package loaded into the car containing explosives because of its careful handling and size, and that the driver's erratic route meant he was trying to evade surveillance. The New York Times has also covered the same story. According to a congressionally mandated Pentagon report, the U.S. military, which invaded and illegally occupied Afghanistan for almost 2 decades, killed 12 Afghan civilians in 2021. The report states they were killed in a botched drone strike the American military carried out in the Afghan capital Kabul on 29th of August 2021. Just 1 day before the phased U.S. military drawdown ended. According to a report released recently, which constitutes only a fraction of the atrocities unleashed by U.S. occupation forces in Afghanistan, 7 of the 10 Afghan civilians killed in that incident were children. It also documents the killing of an Afghan civilian in a U.S. strike on 8th of January in the western Herat province, and another on 11th of August in the southern Kandahar province. The botched drone strike in August of 2021 prompted a half-hearted apology from then-head of the U.S. Central Command, General Frank McKenzie, who admitted it was a mistake. However, no U.S. military officials or troops were punished or held accountable for that deadly drone strike. The Taliban staged a stunning comeback in August of 2021, toppling the Western-backed government in Kabul and forcing the United States and its allies to abandon the country after years of futile military adventure. For 2 decades, the war in Afghanistan remained an enigma for the successive U.S. governments, from George W. Bush to Joe Biden, finally ending in a botched military exit and a disgraceful defeat. It started on 29th of February 2020, when then-US President Donald Trump's administration signed an agreement with the Taliban to pull out US troops from the country by 1st of May 2021. However, the deal failed to de-escalate tensions between the two sides. On 14th of April 2021, President Joe Biden announced that the remaining 2,500 to 3,500 U.S. troops in Afghanistan would be withdrawn by 11th of September to end what he called America's Forever War. Between May and August of 2021, the Taliban overran several key provincial capitals across Afghanistan, which, with the beleaguered Afghan forces offering little resistance. Amid the ensuing chaos and commotion, on 29th of August 2021, a U.S. drone strike killed 10 family members of an Afghan family, including 7 children, near the airport. In September of 2021, the Pentagon acknowledged it was a tragic mistake, but said none of the military personnel involved in the botched drone strike will face any kind of punishment. The website of NPR has also covered the same story and tells us more. The Pentagon said it would not punish the military team behind the errant drone strike that was intended to hit the masterminds of an attack on Kabul airport, but instead killed 10 Afghan civilians, including 7 children. U.S. Defense Department spokesperson John Kirby recently confirmed reports that Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin approved a series of recommendations following an investigation into the deadly incident in August of 2021. Those did not include disciplinary action for the military service members involved in what officials had called a tragic mistake. Pentagon spokesman John Kirby told reporters during a briefing, "The Secretary of Defense is now approving or calling for additional accountability measures. I do not anticipate there being issues of personal accountability to be had with respect to the 29th of August airstrike." Pentagon spokesperson John Kirby said investigations led by General Kenneth McKenzie, who leads U.S. Central Command, and General Richard Clark, the head of the Special Operations Command, resulted in a series of recommendations for procedural changes and process improvements that need to occur and will occur, adding, "But in this particular case, there was not a strong enough case to be made for personal accountability, and no one was found criminally negligent." An investigation by the Air Force's Inspector General, Lieutenant General Sami Saeed, found the deadly mistake was the result of confirmation bias. The New York Times uncovered video footage that challenged the Pentagon's narrative that officials admitted the drone strike had been a mistake. The strike killed Zamari Ahmadi, an employee of U.S.-based Nutrition and Education International, NEI, and 9 members of his family. Last month, Nutrition and Education International founder and president Steve Kwan called the Pentagon's investigation into the incident deeply disappointing and inadequate. The Pentagon promised to pay compensation and also to help relocate abroad family members and Afghans working for Nutrition and Education International, NEI, but that remains stuck on determining just who is qualified.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim. all of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor, Israel. Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Terrorist attack in Shahrah Shrine disgraced the hypocritical, black-hearted Americans. This is the part of Imam Khomeini's speech in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on Tuesday, December 20, 2022, which was delivered when he met with a number of the families of the martyrs who were murdered in the Shahrah terrorist attack. In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful, praise be to God, Lord of the worlds, and peace and blessings be upon our Master, Prophet Muhammad, and upon his pure progeny, particularly the remaining vestige of God on earth. I would like to welcome all you here. The tragic yet glorious tragedy that took place in the holy shrine of Ahmad ibn Musa Shah Cheragh, peace be upon him, is one that will remain permanently in history. First of all, it carries great meaning. Secondly, it is something that will remain. It is not an incident that will be forgotten anytime soon in Iran's history. Ahmad ibn Musa himself was martyred. His honorable brother, Imam Ali ibn Musa Reza alayhi salam, was also martyred. They martyred them so that their names and their memories will be forgiven. But were they forgotten? Was Imam Reza alayhi salam forgotten? Was Shah Cheragh forgotten? Much of the enemy's dismay, the memories of these two, their values, their status, and the greatness of God's mercy on them is becoming more apparent with each passing day.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Of course, the families of the victims are grieving. We understand that completely. They have lost their loved ones, their children, even young children, their parents. There is no doubt about that. They are grieving. People's hearts are aching for them, and so is mine. I, too, was greatly saddened by this tragedy, but in the face of this bereavement, there is a greatness which is the grace that God will bestow on them and you, the loved ones they have left behind. To illustrate the large extent of God's grace towards you, the Almighty God has stated the following in the Holy Quran. It is they who receive the blessings of the Lord and their mercy. The Holy Quran, chapter 2, ayah 157. The word they here referred to people like you. It is they who receive the blessings of the Lord and his mercy. God sends his greetings and blessings upon you, the families, and the bereaved who are mourning over the loss of these martyrs. They, that is the martyrs themselves, have an excellent status.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Russia, Zagreb, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Families of prisoners and their advocates have staged a sit-in inside the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross in the blockaded Gaza Strip on Monday. Their action was in solidarity with thousands of Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails and detention centers. Tel Aviv practices apartheid policies against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, Gaza, and Al-Quds. Among those apartheid policies is the bad treatment of Palestinian prisoners.
The prisoners are suffering tremendously inside Zionist jails, and we pray for their release. My son was only 17 when he was arrested and has been behind bars since 1992. He's a freedom fighter who fought for the liberation of Al-Quds and Palestine.
Palestinian prisoners who are held in 24 Israeli jails and detention centers are all denied basic human rights.
Prisoners' advocacy groups are calling on the international community to hold the Israeli regime accountable for its grave violations against Palestinian prisoners.
Meanwhile, a workshop was held in the blockaded territory on how to tackle the dangers posed by right-wing Israeli minister Itamar Ben-Gvir on Palestinian prisoners. The workshop was organized by Hamas's Wa'id Prisoners Society and the Islamic Jihad's Mujahid al-Quds Foundation for Prisoners. Attendees discussed ways of confronting threats by the extremist Israeli minister.
It's our duty to protect and fight for Palestinian prisoners amid the ongoing attempts by Ben-Gvir and the Zionist entity to pass a law that allows the execution of Palestinian prisoners as well as the deportation of Palestinian prisoners. We are facing a big Zionist project targeting not only the prisoners but also all aspects of Palestinian existence.
For decades, the Israeli regime has violated all the rights and freedoms granted to prisoners by the Fourth Geneva Convention.
The issue of Palestinian prisoners is at the core of the Palestinian cause. They are held in Zionist jails because they fought for the freedom of Palestine and have kept the Palestinian cause alive. Palestinian prisoners have played a major role in fighting the Zionist project that aims to empty Palestine of its indigenous Palestinian population.
Palestinians are calling on the international community to break their silence and help Palestinian prisoners. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
We will not be beaten. This is the title of a newly released documentary produced by Press TV. The documentary has been made based on 5,000 minutes of footage and documents collected and released by the U.S. media regarding domestic violence against women and the violation of women's rights in the United States. We Will Not Be Beaten tells the documented story of the high rate of domestic violence and physical abuse against women in the U.S.
This documentary, ordered by Press TV, has been made based on 5,000 minutes of footage and documents regarding violation of women's rights and violence against women, which have been collected and released by the U.S. media. Also, in order to have a better understanding of the situation in the United States, we have interviewed many people who have been living in the U.S. for 10 to 20 years.
According to official statistics, there are more than 20,000 phone calls placed to domestic violence hotlines in the U.S. every day. Moreover, one in every three women in the U.S. experience rape and physical violence by an intimate partner in their lifetime.
This documentary has shown the realities regarding violation of women's rights and domestic violence against women in the United States. It shows that the only thing that the U.S. does not care about is the rights of women. One example is the U.S. proposed resolution which led to the ouster of Iran from the U.N. Commission on the Status of Women. The production of such documentaries will further shed light on the double standards policies of Washington with regard to women's rights.
While Western media outlets have launched a propaganda against Iran with regard to the status of women, we have released a new documentary titled We Will Not Be Beaten to depict the true status of women in the U.S. As Press TV has been the voice of the voiceless, we have made our efforts to be the voice of the rising number of American women who are facing domestic violence and physical abuse on a daily basis.
Domestic violence against women has seen an alarming uptick in recent years in the United States, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic. A report by the Council on Criminal Justice found that reports of domestic violence in the U.S. have jumped by over 8% during the pandemic lockdown.